this PES Institute lunchtime seminar. Please could I ask, before I go further, please could I ask everyone to mute their microphones? We've just had a blast of the world at one, and interesting though that is, I mean, vital though that is, it would be good if we didn't get it now. Thank you. So I'd like to welcome you all to our second of our seminar series this term. And the series is really explores the intersections between anti-Semitism and other forms of racism and other forms of racialization, the intersections and and also some of the places where there's tension or a lack of intersection.
I'm going to switch video off.
Just excuse me a moment. I'm getting a slightly odd screen here. That's better. When we established this as our theme for the term and for the academic year, I was really keen that we should invite our speaker today, Professor Shirley Gilbert. Shirley is Professor of Modern Jewish History at UCL and also Academic Director of the Sir Martin Gilbert Learning Center. Her publications include Music in the Holocaust, which came out in 2005, and really an extraordinary book, and extraordinary in a wonderful sense, From Things Lost, Forgotten Letters and the Legacy of the Holocaust, which was published in 2017. Most recently with Avril Alba, she edited Holocaust Memory and Racism in the Postwar World, which is as it were, completely on message for the themes that we want to explore this year. So it's with great pleasure and expectation that I invite her to talk to her title for about 25, 30 minutes, Racism, Anti-Semitism, and South African Jewish Perspectives on Victimhood. Just before I finally belt up, I will say that please place any questions you have in the chat section, and I'll do my best to relay them and get through them in the period that we have for discussion after Shirley has spoken. Shirley.
Thank you so much, David. Thank you for the invitation to speak. Thank you, Tan, for all the organization that you did behind the scenes to get us here. And thank you all for coming. It's nice to see some familiar faces, colleagues and friends, and also some new faces. So as David said, I'm going to be talking a little bit about what is a much larger project, looking at how the memory of anti-Semitism and especially the Holocaust has informed South African Jews' self-understanding and engagement with racism in South African society since the 1940s. I began this larger research project looking at how those dynamics emerged during and immediately after the Holocaust, which coincided with a period of virulent local anti-Semitism directed at South African Jews by the Afrikaner nationalist movement. That changed with the election victory of the National Party in 1948 and the subsequent introduction of apartheid legislation, which in the subsequent years ratcheted up the system of racial segregation in South Africa. I also have looked at how these dynamics shifted during the transition to democracy in South Africa during the 1990s. And more recently, I've carried out with my colleague, Professor Deborah Posel, who was at that time at the University of Cape Town, is now at the University of the Free State. We carried out together an interview project exploring how some of these issues are reflected in contemporary Jewish life in South Africa. Now, since I'm limited today to about 25 to 30 minutes, I'm going to say only a very tiny bit about each of these areas, but try and give you a broad overview. And I'll focus my comments with reference to the overarching theme of victimhood, how South African Jews thought about, think about their own victimhood, historical victimhood primarily, that of others, the victimhood of others, and how those two may or may not intersect. So I'm going to start with a few words of historical background, which will be very familiar to some of those of you here today, but perhaps less familiar to others, just to contextualize the comments that I'm going to make. The South African Jewish community today is estimated, as per the last Kaplan Center survey that we just recently had, at around 50,000 people, which is a significant drop from the community's peak of about 120,000 people in the 1970s. And most of that drop has been due to immigration. Most South African Jews are descendants of immigrants from Eastern Europe, especially from Lithuania at the turn of the 20th century, although preceding that, there was a small community that arrived during the 19th century, from the middle of the 19th century, mostly from Britain, Holland, and Germany. Now, Jews' efforts to gain acceptance in the South African racial order depended from the outset on their being recognized as white. This is something that's widely discussed in the literature. These efforts began early in the 19th century as the premium attached to ideas of racial difference rapidly increased. Legislation was accumulating that assigned access to opportunities, to wealth, and to privilege on racial lines. And everyday life was dominated by notions of a supposedly natural racial hierarchy that positioned white people indisputably at the top. For Jews, and particularly for those large numbers of Jews arriving from Eastern Europe, it was clear that prospects for upward mobility and for social and political acceptance, which were some of the key things that they sought by leaving Europe in the first place, that to gain those things would depend on their racial status. And this found them in a potentially uncomfortable position. Having left Europe to avoid persecution and find freedom and opportunity, they found themselves able to acquire those opportunities largely by investing in the racial order. And this paradoxical relationship fundamentally shaped South African Jewry's identity and self-definition in the following decades. Now, Jews' recognition of Jews' whiteness was, of course, not immediately or straightforwardly won. There was widespread anti-Jewish sentiment in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, as our colleague Milton Shane has very extensively documented. And that anti-Semitism targeted both Jewish poverty in the form of the immigrants supposedly invading South Africa's shores, and also targeted Jewish economic success, a contradictory trend that, of course, we've seen elsewhere across the Jewish world historically. In the 1930s and 40s, anti-Semitism in South Africa became increasingly political, influenced in part by the rise of Nazism in Germany. In 1930, the newly passed Quota Act targeted Jewish immigration to South Africa from Lithuania, and the idea of Jewish unassimilability, as it was termed, which questioned the very possibility of Jewish integration into society, was becoming popular in Afrikaner nationalist circles. By the late 1930s, in addition to the growth of several far-right anti-Semitic movements, anti-Semitism had also become an integral part of the mainstream national party's platform. And now at this time, the 1930s and 40s, only around half of Jews living in South Africa were native born. So the unfolding events in Europe had a powerful and, for many of them, a deeply felt personal impact. They were extremely concerned about the fate of friends and family left behind in Eastern Europe. And as the genocide progressed, the almost complete destruction of their spiritual heartland in Lithuania, where 95% of Jews perished, was devastating. And the combination of those two things, Nazi persecution in Europe alongside Nazi-inspired anti-Semitism at home, meant that during the war and immediate post-war years, many South African Jews felt a profound sense both of isolation from the rest of the Jewish world and of vulnerability to anti-Semitism, among other things. Now, from early on, South African Jews' historical victimhood was inseparable from its Zionism. The prospective Jewish homeland was seen very clearly as a refuge for Jews under threat, and it was felt crucially necessary given Jews' experiences of anti-Semitism both abroad in Europe and now in South Africa as well. South African Jews have, of course, long been recognized as among the most ardently Zionist in the diaspora. Although within the community, views have actually spanned the ideological spectrum, the community at large is one of the most ardently Zionist. In Eastern Europe and the United States, Zionists competed for adherence with powerful ideological rivals, particularly the Socialist Bund and Reform Judaism. In South Africa, the lack of significant opposition, particularly on those fronts, allowed the Zionist movement to grow much more freely. After the advent of apartheid in 1948, which of course was the same year in which Israel was established, Zionism became a real focal point of institutional communal life, strongly connected with the powerful memory of recent Jewish persecution. In fact, one could say that during the apartheid years, Zionism and the Holocaust really served in tandem as the kind of central pillars of Jewish, South African Jewish identity and community. Apartheid divided South African Jews, as our colleague Gidi Shimoni, who is sitting here with us, has very beautifully and extensively written about. On the one hand, Jews continued to be overrepresented in leftist political resistance to white supremacy, as indeed they had been since the early 1900s. But those Jews represented only a small fraction of the community, and in many cases, they were unaffiliated with or even ostracized from the mainstream. On the other hand, the majority of Jews accommodated themselves to the principle of white supremacy. They tended not to support the governing National Party, and they were critical of some of its excesses. But on the whole, they lived within the apartheid system without fundamentally challenging it. Ironically, it was apartheid and the totalizing racial order that it entailed that really cemented their status as white. Now, one of the sources of division among Jews during the apartheid period was diverging attitudes towards Jewish victimhood. The Holocaust in particular served as powerful currency in internal debates about how to respond to apartheid, but very distinct memory cultures developed alongside differing political stances. For the minority, the memory of Jewish persecution spurred a powerful commitment to anti-racism and to social justice. And we have many examples of Jewish activists, liberals, intellectuals, rabbis, who explicitly reproached the organized community for its failure to heed what they saw as the lessons of Jewish historical victimhood by recognizing and opposing the victimhood of others. And I'm going to give just a couple of examples. The first one from the educator and activist Franz Auerbach, who was himself a refugee from Nazi Germany. He repeatedly pointed to the, quote, similarities between some present features of life in South Africa and life under Hitler, end of quote. And like many other Jewish activists, he pointedly, very explicitly invoked the comparison in urging his fellow Jews to protest apartheid's injustices. Here's another quote from Auerbach, who said, "To be silent is to betray our history, our religion, and our duty to the land that gave us refuge." To give you a different example from the rabbinate, here's a quote from Rabbi Solomon Rappaport, who had fled Nazi-occupied Vienna in 1938. Rappaport consistently emphasized the implications of Jewish historical experience for the local context. And the quote I'll read you now is from a booklet he wrote titled Rabbinic Thoughts on Race, where he says, "The Jewish people must be ever mindful of the fact that it had been treated in Nazi Germany as an outcast and subjected to systematic genocide on account of alleged biological deficiency of the Semites, for which there was no remedy in the eyes of the Aryan master race. The Jewish people should scrupulously refrain from becoming accessories to any acts of oppression, injustice, or humiliation committed in the name of race, and remain faithful to the ethical fundamentals of their religious heritage." And as I said, we have many similar examples, some of them more and some of them less explicit, in drawing parallels between Nazism and apartheid. In the discourse of most mainstream Jewish institutions, by contrast, the Holocaust was a marker of Jews' enduring vulnerability in the modern world. And throughout the apartheid period, Holocaust remembrance and education focused almost exclusively on internal Jewish concerns about self-preservation and defense, with little or no reference to the local context. Much focus was placed on the young fighters of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, who were unambiguously connected with the reborn new Jew of Israel, who relied on his own strength and defenses in preserving the Jewish future. Holocaust commemoration was indeed substantially shaped by Zionist involvement. So keynote addresses at memorial ceremonies were given by Israeli ambassadors, by local Zionist leaders, by Israeli academics, and Zionist organizations often assisted in coordinating the events. Israel was explicitly portrayed in such events as one event put it, a living memorial to the martyrs and the only lasting solution to anti-Semitism after the Holocaust. The focus on Jewish self-reliance in this discourse of Holocaust memory was justified in part by reference to the world's failure to respond to the persecution of the Jews. Alongside the importance of Israel, speakers at commemorative events repeatedly condemned, quote, the indifference of the world to the Jewish tragedy, charging that millions of Jews went to their deaths while the world stood by and watched. At a ceremony held at a Jewish day school in Johannesburg in April 1960, for example, and here again, I'm just giving you one example, the speaker declared, Jews should remember that though the world professed to be shocked by what was happening in South Africa today, the whole of civilized mankind had stood by during the war and had allowed a third of the Jewish people to perish. The world was deaf to their call for help and was not interested in rescuing them. And here, where you have reference to the local context, the purpose is, of course, not to focus on apartheid, but rather to highlight the failure of the world in another context to help the Jews in the 1940. And once again, I've chosen just a couple of quotes here to represent a much larger store of examples. Across the 1960s, the 70s, even most of the 80s, one finds many similar instances of communal leaders warning of the anti-Semitic dangers that Jews faced in the post-Nazi era and emphasizing the obvious lesson of the Holocaust as it was seen, which was that only Jewish self-reliance, particularly in the form of Israel, could ensure Jewish existence. Jews' experiences of anti-Semitism under the apartheid regime were in fact fairly limited. Until the 1990s, successive communal surveys have emphasized Jews' successful acculturation in South Africa, their rapid upward mobility, their high levels of education and professional success. And annual reports suggest that while anti-Semitism was not absent from South African life during the apartheid period, coming mostly from far-right groups, it was never widespread and certainly never reached the levels that it did elsewhere, for example, in Europe. What has increased, especially since the early 2000s, is anti-Zionism, and this remains one of the most concerning issues for South African Jews today. The ruling African National Congress, ANC, has not taken any actions to prejudice or disadvantage Jews within the country, but perhaps unsurprisingly, given its historic relationship with the Palestinian liberation struggle, the ANC has consistently expressed its opposition to Israeli government policy and action, and its elected officials, as well as, I should say, the mainstream media and much of public discourse, echo the widespread comparison between Israel and apartheid. Jewish communal authorities, in turn, express deep concern about these views, which they perceive to be not only anti-Israel, but also anti-Semitic. To add one more complicated layer to the mix, anti-Zionist attitudes exist in the contemporary South African public sphere alongside a fairly prominent and highly universalized narrative of Holocaust remembrance, which entered mainstream discourse during the political transition of the 1990s. During that time, the Holocaust was frequently invoked as a benchmark for thinking about South Africa's recent past, from the conception of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to the debate about the future of Robben Island. And the Holocaust was also incorporated quite prominently into the national curriculum for history, where it was presented as an exemplary instance of human rights abuse alongside apartheid, colonialism, and slavery. The Holocaust also, paradoxically, since the 1990s, became a means for mainstream Jewry to assert its commitment to the new South Africa. In forums such as the Anne Frank in the World exhibition, which was put on in 1994, and later the Cape Town Holocaust Center, which was established in 1999. So While for much of the apartheid era, as I've suggested, the Holocaust was represented by Jews as a unique event with implications primarily for Jews, it was now seen to have timely and significant lessons for the emergent democracy. Although Jewish institutions today, I think, still retain quite a strong internal focus on the events, on the Holocaust's uniqueness and links with Israel, in present-day South Africa, Holocaust memory is firmly embedded in a universal discourse of human rights, anti-racism, and social justice, as it is in many other parts of the world. So I'm going to move now to summarize the last broad area of research, and that's the project that I carried out with Professor Deborah Posel between 2015 and 2018. And I should acknowledge here the support of the British Academy for funding that project. This consisted of a series of 55 in-depth interviews, which we conducted with South African Jews of varying ages who identify strongly as Jewish, but situate themselves outside of the organized communal mainstream of South African Jewry. And it was a study about South African identity more broadly, although here I'll focus just on this the specific topic of my talk. We will see here some echoes of the diverging Holocaust memory cultures that I described between activist Jews and communal institutions during the apartheid years. But the present day situation is also complicated by those additional layers that I mentioned, the prominence of the Holocaust in public discourse surrounding apartheid, and especially the pervasiveness of Israel apartheid analogies in the South African public sphere. So Deborah and I were struck in our interviews by how many respondents took pains to emphasize to us that the Holocaust was not central to their identity as Jews. In fact, only 4 of the 55 explicitly claimed that the Holocaust was central, said that they would argue that the Holocaust was central. But in the course of many of the interviews, it became clear that the history of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust undoubtedly informed their thinking on a number of issues, including how they understand and how they define their Jewishness and their sense of their role in the world as Jews. And the underlying issue, it emerged, or it seemed to us, was their association of the subject of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust with organized Jewry. Our respondents seemed to be reacting in particular to what they saw as the mainstream community's excessive preoccupation with Jewish victimhood. And they saw that narrative of victimhood underpinned especially by memory of the Holocaust. And they saw that narrative of victimhood being used to justify what they considered problematic attitudes on a range of social and political issues, 2 issues in particular, South African racial issues and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In other words, it wasn't the fact of Jewish historical victimhood that they were rejecting, but rather placing that victimhood at the center of Jewish life and identity. So again, just to give you a few examples, one respondent in his 20s articulated his perspective as follows. He said, "You're fed into this conversation that's going around and circulating almost subconsciously that we're still persecuted and then we're sort of just waiting for the next devastating catastrophe. And that is really strong glue for the community, I think. But it also has really damaging consequences and leads to quite a strange mentality when it comes to viewing everyone else. All the paranoia gets absorbed into the single concept called the Holocaust. I think one of the difficult things for me has been trying to identify how I identify myself as Jewish outside of the parameter of paranoia. I don't want to define my allegiance to Judaism because of a sense of shared suffering, even though I know that so often that's the basis for so many identities, because I don't feel like I've suffered ever." End of quote. So to emphasize, this is a respondent in his 20s, and the vast majority of our respondents in their 20s and 30s echoed these sentiments, saying that they had never experienced anti-Semitism directly in South Africa and didn't feel threatened by it. And they took that one step further and concluded that because they had so little experience of victimhood in the here and now, the community's sense of historical victimhood was disingenuous. Now, there were very clear generational inflections to these views. While some of our older respondents also refused the idea that victimhood was central to their Jewish identities, for them, the threat of anti-Semitism was not so easily dismissed. Some of them because they were closer in time to the earlier histories of anti-Semitism. Some of them had experienced anti-Semitism themselves growing up. And they expressed a sense of vulnerability that complicated the way in which they related to the mainstream. Even though they were also uneasy about some of its attitudes, specifically with regards to Israel-Palestine and South African racial issues, they could also identify with some of its fears, fears about a sense of Jewish vulnerability, about anti-Semitism. And this created a lot of discomfort and ambivalence for some of our older respondents with relation to those issues. So first, on the question of Israel-Palestine, for many of our interviewees, memory of historical anti-Semitism underpinned for them a strong sense of potential Jewish vulnerability, which translated into a deeply felt necessity for a Jewish homeland. But they really struggled to reconcile these emotional connections to Israel with their intense discomfort with the country's politics and also with mainstream Jewry's unquestioning support for Israel. One respondent, who's in his 60s, spent several minutes in our interview insisting that the Holocaust should not be used to justify unjust behavior, particularly in Israel. At the same time, he said, and now I'm quoting, "I think that Jews have been persecuted throughout history, and as such, I think that they have the right to claim something for themselves. I know that people keep saying the Jews are just, everything comes back to the Holocaust, and it gives them the justification to claim what others don't. In the context of the Middle East, people will do a hell of a lot to justify whatever they want to do. But do I believe in a Jewish state? Yes, I believe in a Jewish state. I think they've earned their stripes in a horrible way." One of the things that our respondents were very conscious of was that the idea of Israel as a haven from persecution is a point that is regularly stressed by Israel's less critical defenders. And so they were at pains to differentiate their expression of the need for a Jewish homeland from what they perceived to be the mainstream community's refusal to acknowledge Palestinian suffering, and what they saw as a deliberate mobilization of the Holocaust to justify unquestioning support for Israel. A few of them took their criticism further, identifying a common thread of racism that linked the mainstream outlook on Israel and South Africa. This is a quote from one interviewee in his early 40s who said, "There's a feeling of superiority over Arab people that people don't want to admit is very similar to white people's feelings of superiority over Black people in South Africa." But the same as the other examples that I've already cited, his criticism of Israel, in this case, quite strong criticism of Israel, coexisted with a very intense identification with historic Jewish victimhood, with anti-Semitism, and a very deep-seated, if highly ambivalent, appreciation of the need for a Jewish state. Our interviewees also associated the focus on Jewish victimhood with what they perceived to be the mainstream community's increasing insularity and withdrawal from larger South African society. And in particular, they criticized what they perceived to be racist attitudes both during and after apartheid. This quote is from an interviewee in her 60s who was talking about her relative's ability to express racist attitudes without seeming to recognize the irony of Jews taking such a position. She said, "I remember saying to my grandfather, how can you have these attitudes when Jews have experienced this kind of, I wouldn't have had the word racism, but I couldn't understand how he could have racist attitudes when the Jews had been at the receiving end of racist attitudes. And I remember asking him about it. And I remember what he said to me. He said, ach, you know, I don't even like to repeat it. These Schwarzes, you know, if I could pull myself up by my own bootstraps, so can they. Why haven't they done that?" So, I mean, he didn't really understand structural inequality. That's the end of that quote. During apartheid, the dearth of Jewish opposition to the regime was often ascribed to fears for Jewish safety, given the history of Afrikaner anti-Semitism and, of course, the context of a police state. For some of our respondents in the project, though, the insistence on victimhood was a disingenuous defense for the refusal to speak out against apartheid before the mid-1980s and also for continuing racist attitudes since the end of apartheid, and for some of them really continuing to the present day. So that's a very brief summary of quite large segments of the research, and I've glossed over various nuances and complexities, but I think I will leave it there for now and leave it to your comments and questions, perhaps to untangle those a little bit further.
Thank you very much indeed, Shirley. That was really fascinating. Lots and lots of issues that you touched on. I'll just remind people to place any questions they have in the chat. While you do that, I'll start things off by asking you, I suppose it's a historian's question in a way, which is about, so you spoke about many things which are familiar certainly in the English-speaking world, and not only in South Africa, and not only in the English-speaking world, the particularly the divergent responses, the divergent political responses in the present to Holocaust memory. On the one hand, a universalizing response; on the other hand, an emphasis on Jewish vulnerability and the need for a Jewish for Jewish self-help. I suppose my question then is, to what extent, though, was this a response to the Holocaust itself, or to the formalization of segregation that came after the Second World War, were the particularities of South Africa? That's what I'm really asking about in this long-winded way. What makes South Africa particular, and South African Jewry particular? Were those particularities already in place before the Second World War? And what I have in mind here is your sort of very interesting comments about the early dominance of Zionism, and indeed, as I know, a sort of a Likud type of Zionism, a revisionist sort of Zionism in South African Jewry, whereas the sort of dominance of a Zionism in Jewish communities elsewhere was only established after the creation of the State of Israel.
Mm. So it's a good question, and I mean, you're right, these kind of the particular universal tension in Holocaust memorialization is one that we see in many diaspora communities, and in Israel for that matter as well. And the South African particularities, I suppose, in the various parts of the research, there are South African particularities that one could point to, at the same time as there are also trends as far as, for example, responding to, you know, a racist political order. You will have echoes of that in many other different racialized contexts, and similarly in South Africa. I'll maybe start from the back of the research, that the last bit of the research that I mentioned, and that's the kind of the contemporary tension. And one of the things that was really striking to us coming out of this research was when these tensions began to emerge. And it seemed to us that it was really in response to the growing dominance of Israel apartheid analogies, really only since the beginning of the 2000s. Mm-hmm. And that discourse placed this group of progressive Jews in a position that was more pointed and more highly charged than it was for Jews elsewhere in the diaspora, you know, many of whom are uncomfortable with the analogy with apartheid, but for whom it carries different associations and who are living in a very different context. You know, one of our interviewees said to us, you know, in the context of present day South Africa, Zionism is the racism of our times. To talk about Zionism, there's such an equation between them that to proclaim any kind of support for Israel, that to proclaim oneself a Zionist in the context of present day South Africa is that much more highly charged than it is for Jews elsewhere in the diaspora. So that seemed to us something that was distinctive about this community. The question of how Zionism plays into all of this before World War II is an interesting one. And certainly, as I said in my overview, what's interesting about Zionism in South Africa is that it is such an unchallenged ideology right from the outset. You know, so right from 1897, you have a Zionist society sprouting up all over South Africa, and there aren't a lot of ideological rivals to challenge them. And during apartheid, it became, you know, Zionism became an even smoother and easier identity that actually fit really well into apartheid's notions of separate development, where a kind of distinctive national identity not only was not the kind of dual loyalty that would have been thrown back in Jews' faces elsewhere in the diaspora, but was actually a distinctiveness that was kind of encouraged. I'm talking around your question, I think, and not getting to the heart of it, but it's an interesting question for me to think about further as far as the pre-1940s are concerned. So thank you.
Thank you, Shirley. So we have other questions. I'll relay two, because one is one for information. Maggie asks, says it's a brilliant insight into a hugely complex situation. Is it possible to read more on these interviews? And in addition, I'll pass on a slightly larger question from Tony Booth. Did the Rwandan or Balkan massacres ever come into people's reflections on Jewish victimhood and the Holocaust?
Thanks. So I'm looking at the questions in the chat, and I may just, unless you want to relay them, David, I'm happy to kind of respond to them as I see them. So just to answer Maggie's question briefly, which is to say, yes, we have written up these, some of the research findings in the form of articles, which are currently in press, one with the Journal of Modern Jewish Studies and one with the Journal of Jewish Identities, and there will be more. So I'm glad to send out information about that, but those will appear, what are we now, November, so probably at some point in early to the middle of 2021. The question of whether the Rwandan or Balkan massacres ever come into people's reflections, not in our interviews and not as I've seen it extensively in public discourse, but the person really to ask about this is also sitting with us here today, and that's Tali Nates, who's the director of the Johannesburg Holocaust and Genocide Center, which took a turn from the other Holocaust centers in South Africa by specifically focusing on Rwanda. So I mentioned the Cape Town Holocaust Center, which was established in 1999. And after that, a Holocaust center was established in Durban. And Tully spearheaded the creation of the Johannesburg Center, also explicitly calling it the Johannesburg Holocaust and Genocide Center. The umbrella body has since gone to rename itself the South African Holocaust and Genocide Foundation. And Tully's conception behind that museum, which also I was played a little bit of a role in thinking through, was to think about how a recent African genocide could inform, shape, think about how South Africans think about the Holocaust. So the extent to which that has changed public discourse, has changed the kinds of conversations that are being had, is not something that I've seen. Certainly it's not something that came out in the interviews at all, but is an interesting question. So Tully then asks, can you reflect on the key change you found in attitudes to Israel and Zionism and also to orthodoxy or religion since democracy? Yes, I mean, that's another part of the context that I didn't talk about at all. And that is the South African Jewish community's increasing turn to the right, both politically and religiously, a real increased religiosity. Organizations like Or Sameach and Eish HaTorah have really made quite great inroads into the community. And this in turn, this religiosity also has effects on all sorts of aspects of life, including attitudes towards Israel, including social encounters and relationships with non-Jews. It's a huge, big topic, apart from saying, yes, partly that also has to do with at the very least, a continuation of the commitment to Zionism in Israel that we've always seen among South African Jews. It's clear that that's continued. The recent Kaplan survey that came out made clear that Zionism is still extremely strong among South African Jews. And to that, I would also add the anti-Zionist context, which I mentioned, but there's a really strong feeling of vulnerability of the Jewish community from anti-Semitism and especially anti-Israel discourse in the public sphere. So that is also impacted. Was South Africa ever considered as a Jewish homeland in early Zionist discourse? Not that I've seen. I've certainly seen what they call Uganda, but was actually the Kenyan highlands. I've seen Argentina, but I've not seen South Africa. To label the interviewees, this is from Martin Plaut, to label the interviewees as progressive is, of course, a value judgment. That they hold views that differentiate themselves from the majority of the Jewish community appears clear, but progress or lack of progress is not apparent. Okay. In the article, we are much more careful, as one is when one is writing, to define exactly how it is that we decided on this group of interviewees. And I've used the word progressive as it sounds like unhelpful shorthand in this case, but we approached people who felt themselves to be outside or apart from the Jewish communal mainstream in some way. Almost all of these situated themselves on the left in some way or another. But it was they represented without doubt a wide spectrum. David, the questions are now coming thick and fast, so I think I'm actually going to change my mind and have you screen some of them and just perhaps convey some of them. Otherwise, I'm just no way going to get through all of them because some are coming to me directly too.
Well, I'm glad and not to have been made entirely redundant, Shirley. Thank you. So Douglas Rossenau asks, how much have you considered comparisons to the USA? The Jewish community there was also strongly Zionist in the post-48 period when racial apartheid was under attack and started to break down rather than being instituted. Yet the similarities between Jewish stances re-Zionism in the two countries in this period and the trends of thought over time may be more similar than different. What are your thoughts?
Yes, another tiny subject, and a lot could be said about this. I mean, you know, we're talking about a really, really long period. So maybe I'll kind of, I'll pull out little threads. I think you're right, Douglas, to say that there are obviously some resonances, some similarities, both in the encounter with and engagement with issues of race. As different as those contexts were, there are obviously parallels, links, resonances, and also with the attitude to Israel. I would say the key difference, I suppose, and I'm thinking largely about the contemporary period again, maybe because these interviews are most prominent in my mind. I'm thinking about the kind of conversation that has been introduced by people like Peter Baynard, who has taken a more radical stance more recently, but for some time before that was trying to kind of introduce this conversation more into the mainstream of communal Jewry, of scholars like Dov Waxman and others who said there is a growing schism within the American Jewish community, which to some extent, yes, reflects the kind of tensions that we've seen in our interviews, but there is much more space, it seems to me, in the American context for these kinds of conversations to happen. There is still a mainstream community. I just have to also put a little asterisk here and say, when we talk about mainstream communities and communal institutions, the contexts are so different because South Africa is such a highly centralized and always has been highly centralized community, which relies on a series of nationwide bodies that really have a hand in almost all aspects of Jewish communal life, whereas in the United States, it's much more diffuse. Nonetheless, putting aside that caveat, there is, of course, in the United States, there are communal institutions, mainstream institutions, who are very concerned about the critical discourse that is coming out around Israel, about some of the initiatives, critical initiatives coming out from Jewish groups and Jewish individuals. But it seems to me that there is, because of the nature of American Jewry and the space and the very different contexts, that there is more space to have those conversations, whereas in South Africa, it is still proving incredibly difficult. If there was one overriding conclusion from everything we spoke about in the interviews, it was that there are things that Jews find it almost impossible to discuss in the public sphere in South Africa today. And there is a current initiative, the Jewish Democratic Initiative, which is trying to open up some of these conversations, but there is much more of a sense, it seems to me, there of the impossibility of conversation. So not really a fair answer to a very, very large question, but hopefully I got bits of it.
Thank you, Shirley. That's interesting. I mean, the impact of a centralized Jewish communal life raises sort of interesting possibilities of comparison with the UK, which in that sense is more like South Africa than either are to the United States. And Nancy Al-Hachem asks, did the Jewish community in South Africa contribute consciously to the apartheid system?
Can you turn down the music a little bit, please?
And is there a memory of it in the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement? There is some research on Jewish artists in South Africa representing Black people according to certain prejudices. And I wonder if there is awareness of the role of Jews, perhaps of the role of Jews in that, and not a clear-cut distinction, perhaps, between victim and perpetrator, but maybe something in between.
So it's another interesting and important and large question, and a difficult one to answer definitively. So there's been a lot of work to document the work that South African Jews did to oppose apartheid. Did they do things to consciously support the apartheid system? Well, it's very difficult to find that kind of evidence. Do we have evidence that large numbers of Jews voted for the National Party? No, not necessarily. In fact, the evidence suggests that probably large numbers of Jews did not support the National Party. We do have some examples. For example, Percy Utar, or, you know, Jews who were happy to work for the state, but not many examples of that. I think it seems to me, the larger question that is underlying Nancy's question is about, you know, where exactly did Jews sit? And it is this blurry line somewhere between victim and perpetrator. Well, certainly they were not victims of apartheid. Were they perpetrators of apartheid? I think that would also be difficult to argue that anything other than a small handful of Jews who may have been invested in the system itself, it would be very difficult to argue that Jews were perpetrators of the apartheid system. Were they beneficiaries? Without doubt, as white people were. But I think to really try and understand what was that role, what was their relationship towards the racial system, how did they understand it, how did they perceive themselves in relation to it, I think we have to move beyond looking at communal institutions or the public pronouncements of communal leaders or of rabbis, because those tend to be, or they tend to give us less insight into that blurry position. So I think, you know, we do have some new research that is beginning to look beyond those public spaces into the spheres where we might see more of that blurriness. For example, I have a PhD student who is looking at the domestic sphere and looking especially at Jewish women's relationships with their domestic workers, to the extent that one can even excavate that. It's a very difficult project. But it seems to me that that is a bigger question that we haven't really began to open up. I don't think that conversation has been had to any significant degree among South African Jews. You know, once we get beyond the defensive postures of the what do Jews do during apartheid, that conversation has been had a ton. And Gidi Shimoni, as I said, has written the definitive book about Jewish communal institutions and activists and so on. I highly recommend it to everybody. It's called Community and Conscience. You know, we know about that. We've had that conversation, but I think there is a deeper sphere of attitudes, which is difficult to get to, but perhaps more important for us to get to now.
Adam Sutcliffe asks, what's the place in your story of the links, including military and nuclear links between Israel and the apartheid regime? What sort of consciousness and thinking about this was there in the South African Jewish community during apartheid? And what sort of reckoning has there been with this in South Africa since the 90s, both in general and in the Jewish community?
Okay, so thank you, Adam, for the question. So in a way, the actual links themselves is the easier part of the question. It's also something that has been documented. There's a book by Sasha Polakow-Saransky, who wrote a book called, I can't remember what it was called now, maybe The Unholy Alliance or something like that, The Something Alliance, which is looking at those links that developed, particularly in the 1970s, between two governments perceiving themselves as pariahs in the international arena, sharing military technology, particularly sharing nuclear technology. The more interesting part of the question, it seems to me, is about what those links meant, what consciousness there was about those links and the reckoning. And I think my answer to your question is very little. The question about what consciousness there was, I think, you know, there clearly was some awareness of what was going on. You know, there were people working for companies who had developed links. There were people who were, you know, on the ground in concrete ways involved in those links. And there's no question that they were known about. Were they discussed on a communal level? No. Was it something that was, you know, part of the community's public discourse? No, not to any degree that I'm aware of. And the reckoning, again, you know, there alongside what is to my mind a real lack of reckoning with the apartheid past in general, there has not been very much reckoning with this. Now, I have to also put a caveat in here, knowing that this is an extremely loaded, sensitive, highly charged subject. There are lots of reasons why that reckoning hasn't happened. You know, I don't say this as a judgment. And I think there are lots of reasons, lots of things that make that kind of reckoning extremely difficult in the current context.
Thank you, Shirley. We have a question from Miri Rubin, but which is, with changes in the environment of the Republic of South Africa universities, is higher equation being sought abroad?
Sorry, David, it was supposed to be education. Correction.
No, sorry, Miri.
I was just wondering, given that both as students and as academics, Jews did flourish in South African universities, but also so much has been happening in terms of the higher education environment. And this could be a way that, you know, people will choose education abroad, and that would obviously mean that people leave. So I was just wondering if although it's quite recent history, if you could comment a little bit about how that's affecting the community and its prospects.
Sure. And just to apologize, it sounds like you lost me halfway through the response to Adam's question. But Adam, I can give you the rest of the answer if you're interested at some point. It's very hard because of Israel apartheid. It makes that kind of reckoning in the public sphere almost impossible. And just to give you a flavor of that, Amiri, I will come to your question. Just to give you a flavor of it, the first time I presented Deborah and I presented the findings of our interviews, let's just say it was a very, very, very uncomfortable and aggressive environment in the hall. These are very difficult things to talk about. So a reckoning seems very far away. Universities. So universities are a very difficult context. And actually, one of the things that really came out of the interviews, we interviewed, I can't remember how many, maybe about 15 young Jews who either were at university or had just finished university. The universities particularly are felt to be a difficult context where Jews feel under threat, not because of their Jewishness, but because of their whiteness. You know, being told you're a colonizer, go home. And it's that larger context that I think has led some, perhaps many young people at least to consider immigrating. If you look at the recent Kaplan Center survey, it makes clear that many young people are at least thinking about immigrating. I don't know the numbers about university attendance, but anecdotally, I would say, yes, probably there are larger numbers than there were in previous decades. But it's not just universities, it's a larger context of whiteness, you know, whiteness making people feel under threat, possibly even more than Jewishness. Although anti-Israel feeling on campuses also does not help.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shirley. There's one last question we have from Milena Cosentino, which asks whether you include Jews from Rhodes or perhaps the Sephardi minority more widely in South Africa.
Well, that's the first short answer I have today is to say no, that community hasn't yet come into my research, but it is one of the pockets of South African Jewish history, and there are many that have not been sufficiently researched and that hopefully will begin to be researched by new scholars, if we're lucky, in the years to come.
Well, Shirley, that might be your one short answer, but you've been hugely generous with all of your responses to which I think have been a really interesting but also taxing set of questions, but an engaged set of questions, which only came because your presentation and paper was so rich and stimulating. And I'm so glad we heard you this afternoon, and my great thanks to you, Shirley. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming and for your questions.
Yes, thank you all for coming. And I think I'm instructed to say now that the seminar is now over.
Thank you so much, Shirley. Thank you.
Thank you.